Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple: to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside. I'm your host, Keith Norris. Our guest today is Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth. Gwen is a leading hands-on expert in visual thinking, visual operational conversions, and visual management and leadership. She's the author of 7 books. She's a Shingo faculty fellow and lifetime Shingo Academy member. Gwendolyn lives in Europe and is working with companies all over the world. When she's not with a client or writing, she can be found hiking. Gwen, welcome back. It's so great to have you back again. Excited for our conversation today.
Thank you. Me too. Thanks.
Wonderful. And where are you located at today?
Today, I am still in Ireland. It's only been a few weeks since I last saw you. And I don't know, it's raining today. Last time it was sunny. So this is Ireland.
Well, you haven't picked up the Irish accent yet.
And nor do I understand it.
I watch a bunch of cycling races with a guy named Sean Kelly from Ireland, and I love hearing his accent, especially the way he says 33rd.
Was that an Irish accent?
No, that was not an Irish accent. It sounds like Turty Turd when he says 33rd.
Yes, that's right. Your T's are D's. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have a great conversation today. We're going to get into topics like Obeya primarily. But before we get in, we always like to talk to our guest about the spark. And I'm curious if you could share with us maybe a moment that you recall from your early beginnings when you were first inspired or the spark was established for you in this visuality area.
I have only one spark that got me started, and it was like the big boom or the big bang. It just kept on going. It just kept me going. I mean, it triggered me. It ignited me. And I told that the last time.
It was like the big bang?
It was like the Big Bang, honestly. Just something. There's a poem by Pablo Neruda. He says, something ignited in my soul, fever or unremembered wings. And I went my own way deciphering that burning fire. And that's what it was for me. Something ignited in my soul, fever or unremembered. And something ignited in my soul, fever or unremembered wings. And I went my own way deciphering that burning fire. And I wrote the first bare line, my first visual device. Air without substance, pure foolishness, pure wisdom of one who knows nothing. And suddenly I saw the heavens unfasten and open.
Oh, I love it.
No, it's wonderful. This guy.
Who's that by?
Pablo Neruda. He was sort of the poet laureate of his home country, which I don't think was Spain. I'm sorry. I think it was a South American country. He was, you know, one like Gauguin. He was 39 years old, a bank teller. He was doing something completely not poetry. And then suddenly it was ignition. And that's the way it was for me. I mean, I was about your age, maybe a little younger, when I discovered visuality on the floor of that production system.
Just a teenager, right?
That's right. Yes, a mere child. But that's the way it is. It's called a calling, but the calling is something is calling you and you respond. You don't even know you're responding. You just say yes. And all of a sudden, it's taken you. I consider it very lucky because I'm fundamentally an ambivalent person. It's one of the reasons why I can research methodologies and why I can discover new ways. It's because I'm curious about why did that happen. So there's a lot of ambivalence in me. And the fact that that was decided for me was a gift of the highest order. I'm very grateful. I hope it happens to everyone.
I think that's such a, you know, we've all been around these people that are mission driven, that have found their purpose, their meaning. And, you know, for anybody that it's not clear, tell us how would you describe what your mission is? This really what you've made your life's work. Describe it for us.
Well, you know, it may surprise you. I don't think we've ever had this conversation, Keith. First, it was to discover the world of visuality. And then visuality began to teach me about these higher dimensions, these higher truths or higher purposes. First, I just wanted to help people with their 5S. I wanted to stop failing at 5S. And I found the way out of that. And that was what led me to the whole work that makes sense, operator-led visuality. I turned it over to the operators. I taught the operators really interesting things. They were like engineering principles about how to think about their workplace and how to think about information and how to discover the missing information, how to discover what wasn't there that was causing their struggle. That's that whole discussion about motion. Motion is the footprint of information deficits. That's 15 years of my life discovering that. And then when I got that in place, and that was purposeful enough, and it was so exciting. I think we're going to be talking about discovery today. I hope we do. I know we're going to get on to Obeya, and I want it to be within the same frame, so it's appropriate that we begin in this way. But when I had guaranteed success with that. I knew the methodology. I knew the framework. I knew what the infrastructure had to be. I did it enough times with my clients to say, this is a reliable methodology. I began to entertain the possibility of expanding the scope beyond operators. What would it be like? And this term will be somewhat new to people who haven't followed my work or tuned into you before. But my work is eye-driven. It's about language, visual language, physical devices, visual solutions that come out of the thinking of individuals. And it's based on their need to know. That's where it begins. And then, after they get control of their corner of the world through visual devices, then it shifts to their need to share. I discovered those questions in the 80s, 1980s, but they played themselves out. And I had the marvelous opportunity to explore that. And then I said, what would it be for CEOs? What would it be for supervisors? What is their need to know, their need to share? What is the compulsion? What does a workplace that speaks mean to the rest of the workforce? Because anyone who's ever failed at 5S has had their heart broken. Because when you work with operators, it's just so much fun. There's so much grit. There's so much controversy and, you know, celebration as operators and value-add associates get control of their corner of the world. A whole new dimension of operators, of the operators, begins to blossom. And I loved it. I mean, when you see people grow and you have any role in that growth, you love it. You want more of it. You feel like you're contributing. You feel like, you know, boy, oh boy, oh boy. And so then I moved to supervisors, and that was visual displays. Very, very important methodology, which we'll be only touching on today. Then the C-suite, and then executives, general managers have a language. So what we're doing in visuality is installing a language appropriate to your operational or company function so that the workplace speaks. And when you have these different workplaces speaking to each other, you have what's called a dynamic system. And a dynamic system, its central quality of a system period, let alone a high-performing system, is that it talks to itself. It's like our immune system. It's like all the systems in our body, highly integrated and connected. Something goes wrong with my elbow, I'm going to know about it somewhere on my left hip. You know, it's all connected. The thigh bone is connected to the...
I like the old song. You know that old song. Let me drill down on a couple of things that you just said.
Because you shared... For myself. Go ahead.
You went right through two really amazing questions. I love questions. I feel like having the right question at the right time can solve so many problems in life. But there's two questions that you touched on right there. Mm-hmm. The what do I need to know? and what do I need to share? You said that you discovered those long ago. Is there, do you recall like when that light first came to you of those two questions? Because I feel like you said, that thread has woven through your work, those two questions.
Yes, it was another gift. A lot of things happened to me in the middle of the night. I like to get up early, but I like to stay up late. It's ruining my health because it gets very, very quiet at night. And I remember that it wasn't even a struggle to find them. It was just bing, bam, bing, bam. What do I need to know? What do I need to share? Because I was focused on the eye and I was looking for a way to connect the eye to a shovel or a tool that would allow us to dig into what's called struggle and come up with a cause of visual devices. Where do visual devices come from? Was a question that I never asked until I got the answer. But what I heard, and it was like a sound in my head. We, in general, the world is getting very weird now, so I can say these things without being stoned to death. But, I mean, I heard it, and it was, what do I need to know? What do I need to share? What was so interesting about it is that when I presented this idea to a clever, very clever designer, just a woman I happened to know, be working with, she was in a different department when I was still at Productivity, and she looked at it and she said, you had to say something else. And she wrote it down. What do I need to know that I don't know right now in order to do my work? And Virginia, her name was Virginia Hallman. I said, oh, my God, thank you. This was just such a gift. And what's so interesting about it is that people would go really crazy in a not a good way because I said, what do I need to know? And they said, well, what about we? There's no I in Teams and, you know, all of this marketing stuff. And I thought, oh. And I said, oh, it's in the second question.
Second question.
What do I need to share? Can you hear the we in that? I remember saying that. Can you hear the we in that? What do I need to share? And Virginia, help me. What do I know that you need to know that I need to share so you can do your work? Can you hear the we in that? Can you hear the team in that? Can you hear the servant leadership? And can you imagine what happens when an operator who has zero power, this was the workplace many, many years ago, suddenly positioning him or herself in the position of helping others powerfully. Wow, what's that going to do to the mix? It was that these were days of revolution and those two questions were some.
I love those two questions. And for anybody who's looking for just something useful that you can get out of this podcast and just even in a few seconds, those two questions, I heard those from one of your podcasts and I use those all the time. They're part of my Bible as a manager because they can be so insightful. Gwen, I want to touch on a few terms that you...
Let's just build on that. They're not just insightful, but they allow the person using them to become active and self-directed. So if I am given the assignment, either, for example, what do you need to know? You can do that in a group. But when you leave the room, I want you to keep, here's a memo pad. I want you to keep track of the other things you need to know that you're going to discover when you go back to your work today. You do that with supervisors. They'll have a list as long as their arm and their leg. Supervisors are tremendously benefited by visuality. They are the overlooked middle of our organization. They're the glue and they deserve it.
I want to, you know, because folks listen to this podcast or have different levels of familiarity with all of these terms, I like to try to make sure we get some definitions when we use a term that's maybe a little unfamiliar. So I want to ask you about the first one. You used the term eye-driven that I think could, you know, somebody could think that that's E-Y-E or the letter I. Tell us what eye-driven means for Gwen.
Yes. Thank you. Interestingly, in this case, doesn't mean the eye, but is directly connected to the eye of visuality. It means powered by the individual, whoever that is. I've always, and this is an example at the beginning, you were asking me about kind of the growth of the field as I began to discover it. And I began to understand that visuality really created a very coherent diversity of people, thinking, needs, responses, and solutions. A diversity of solutions means you're building the language of visuality, that people have different needs to know, and they become educated to their need to share. But they're highly diverse. They can be grouped into categories. They can be clustered. You can create a taxonomy on them. But in reality, that means just a groups of categories, types. But in reality, that diversity gets highly uniformed because of the language that is created to connect need to know and need to share. So the power of the eye, and this was many years ago, when there wasn't really a good understanding of people-centric companies, leadership, or empowerment, you know, truly empowerment, that empowerment meant at that time for my colleagues in continuous improvement and in lean, give them something to do, they have a contribution to make. But I was interested, I sort of really, really like to take things to their extreme to see if the extreme works and then back off if I need to. But I wanted to know what would happen if I left operators alone and just informed them, educated them to the possibilities, and then enticed them, seduced them with really cool visual devices that other operators had developed. And what I saw was the room got very quiet when I put interesting devices up, so much so that I used to, during the break, run to somebody who was a colleague and say, am I bombing? There's nobody saying anything. And they said, no, it's because they're not in the room. They're on the screen. They're with you, figuring out what those devices are. Because I say, what do you think's going on here? It's called teaching with no answers. And it's very, very powerful, especially if you're trying to get, I've done this with kids. I have a really lovely family that I've come to know in Uganda. And the society is very different. And we're trying to get the kids to kind of become part of the family and not just, you know, come home to eat and drink and be quiet. And it works very, very well with kids where you teach with no answers. You say, what is this? What do you think? You couple teaching with no answers with something else I discovered, which is called talk amongst yourselves. So you give the question, but first you say, now in a minute, I'm going to ask you a question. And I'm going to ask you to ask your partner what the answer is. And your partner is going to ask you what the answer is. So I want you to talk amongst yourselves about this question I'm about to give you. I've just given them two powerful soft skills for trainers, where trainers can really begin to weave the unity of the group, weave that unity, cause it to happen, and create this thing that is indispensable to your work and mine and the work of the world, create flow. So we ask a question without an answer. It's interesting enough and juicy enough for people to have at least an opinion. And you say, now find the answer from your partner. See if your answer, if your partner knows. Those two things working together. And the room would go completely, I would hardly get that out after three or four times when they got used to that this was always going to be a part of it. They were already talking to each other because they wanted to discover it. And this is discovering it this way. The flow is happening this way. You're up there and you say, okay, what have you got for me? And the flow goes woof. And you have a completely inhabited room that is vibrant with life, that has this dynamic feedback happening all the time. And it's an environment of learning and it is powerful. So I became very interested in how to power operators by turning to them for their own power. The language that evolved around that, the way I talk about it now, is the will. And that's where, in our last conversation, we talked about, will I be the hero of my own life? So what's very interesting about doing that, Keith, is that you are standing there with the complete expectation that somebody will have something to say and more than one person, and that there'll be a conversation. There's no tentativeness. There's an expectation of course, let's talk about it. It's interesting. I mean, some of the visual devices I could show you right now are so interesting. And they are the expression of people who have a fierce need to know because they're about to lose their job. I'm thinking about a gentleman named Fitz from Holland I worked with a number of years ago, and he was going to lose his job as director of operations for five plants because his meetings were so boring. I mean, so boring. And he thought it was because he was too tall. He was taller than anybody else. It was true. I said, I just sat through three of them and I'm ready to chew on my elbow. I can't even reach my elbow, but I'll do anything. Why? Why do you sit so that it looks like your head, is sitting on the table? He would like this. And I said, Fitz, what's going on? He said, I'm too tall. And I said, why do you think? He said, I had such great teams. I worked at a Japanese company before I came here and we got along so well. And I can't figure out why it's not happening here. And I think it's because I'm too tall. God bless him. I mean, how can you be anything but just say, oh my God, you're so gorgeous. Let's do something about that. Let's test that theory. And right. I talked to him about organizing his meeting. And I'm going to push this in the direction of Obeya so we get to the topic then, a little bit of the topic that we said, but it's all connected. At least it in the unfoldment of my life and my research into this work. It was like one thing led to another. If I just kept going, something would be discovered. I just had to keep going. It was a journey of discovery. And he had 15 people coming in every day for 45 minutes. It was maybe 12, sitting around a table. And if you wanted to moan and complain, you would sit in the first six chairs. If you didn't want to open your mouth, you'd sit in the chairs on this side. People would run into the room and they would take their favorite seat. And everybody hated the meeting and the boss was going to fire Fitz. That was his solution. I said, Hank, don't fire him. We're going to do visual displays. And he created a visual displays that was so extraordinary. I coached him, it's true. But he took it to the next level. And it completely changed his job, his identity, his effectiveness. And it proved to me that visuality is about creating a language that is eye-driven. I want to say to the people who are listening and who are hearing anarchy, anarchy, out of control, you do this on a pilot cycle basis. You do it with small designed groups. And then you do another cycle and another cycle and another cycle. You're not converting your plant all at once. First of all, the plant couldn't absorb that much improvement. And secondly, you couldn't keep track of it. So don't worry about, we're not talking about deployment now, but be assured that the deployment matches the robustness of the change content. So it's appropriate. It's not out of control. There's nothing worse for a consultant, an outside consultant like me, than something going off the rails. We are responsible for your outcomes, and we are responsible for teaching you how to replicate that. So, but what it said to me was another dimension was exerting itself, which is people have to find a way to structure their complaints about what's going on, and almost 99% of the complaints that we find in the early stages of every company on its journey to operational excellence is information deficits, missing information. I don't know this. I can't get that. What's the status? What's the problem? What's the defect? What's the goal of this information? It's this huge company. It's this huge amalgam of information. And where there's a deficit, there's a hole, and it can suck the life out of the company. So that's to answer the very first question that you asked about, tell us about the work, your work. What's it mean? It means taking the struggle out of work, out of the department, out of the individual's 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour shift so that they can flow and do something else with their incredible resources than fight either against information deficits or fight against somebody who has the information they want and won't give it, can't give it, is on vacation. All of this meaningless struggle that eats our heart out. I didn't know that when it began. Luckily, I was brought by the nose, bit by bit, and discovered these things. It would have gone past me if you said that this was what it was about. And I'm going to go one level higher. What it's about, which I discovered about 15 years ago, it's about shifting people's identity. It's about taking the stress off of them sufficiently to give them margin for this internal resource simply to grow. We cannot grow under pressure. We have to have a little bit of a lift. When you see that mushroom pushing through the asphalt, it's reaching for the light. That asphalt has enough give to respond to the little baby mushroom. And it pops up and it sits there with a little asphalt hat. You've seen this. You've seen pictures. I mean, this is what life is about. What would it be like to give if visuality actually reduced the stress sufficiently to give people a chance to grow into next, whoever they are next? I've seen.
So it can be said that the Inuit people have 200 different words for precipitation, from snow to sleet to hail to rain to mist, all these different things. Visuality for some people might just be precipitation. Could you put some language to some of these different elements of visuality so that we can build some language with you?
Yes, 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 of course. And before I do, let me congratulate you and call out that you are saying the names of things matter. And this is more true in my life than I ever imagined it would be, but it is the name of the game for me. I have to be able to name it. If I'm going to teach it, I have to name it.
So one of the mentors, when I've talked about processes, like processes can always be broken down and sometimes infinitely. If there are just some big, if we were to take visuality and just break it down into its three or its five biggest chunks, how many chunks are there in your vocabulary? And could you at least name a few of them? I don't know how long that list is, but give us a few to just orient that these are different things.
All right. So visual devices and visual solutions are pretty much the same thing. Visual controls are not the same. People use those three words interchangeably. Two of them are alike, one of them is not. A visual device is a generic term, a visual solution. It doesn't talk about the power of the device, of the solution. It just says it is a device. It's like saying this is a glass. And I've got another thing over there that's a glass, another glass. And then there's something called a cup. Cup has a handle on it. Okay, so as soon as you mention visual controls, you are talking about controlling the behavior of the person who's going to use that device, that controlling device. So a visual control is a visual device that is powerful in controlling the behavior of the user. For example, I'll go through the four power levels. It'll make it easy. I won't be able to illustrate it because I don't have the props with me, but I'll give it a try. This could be said to be a visual indicator. It just tells you something. It just tells you. Okay. It's a visual indicator. It's two-dimensional. Visual indicator is my business card. Two-dimensional. It tells you something. It has no power to make me do anything. Even if it says, stop, danger, children playing, it can't stop me. I might increase the power of that stop, danger, children playing by putting a flashing light. The flashing light adds power to the visual indicator because it draws our attention. Visuality is, we're sight dominant, plenty of sounds that are visual, that are devices, but they're different sensory devices, but it's the same thing. They share information. But a flashing light or a dinging bell will grab our attention and we will see the visual indicator that says, stop, danger, children playing. It still doesn't make us do it, but it at least increases the odds that we'll see it and engage our will and do whatever the sign says. We'll obey. A visual control will get past the election of will I or won't I and make me. Now, if we're following the same sequence, the visual control would be the speed bump. The speed bump makes me slow down. They usually come in pairs. So even if you don't see the first one, there's going to be a second one, right? Right? So that's a visual control. And actually, there's been endless discussion, all of it interesting, about if is that a control or a guarantee? Another word for a visual guarantee is poke-yoke, fail-safe, mistake-proofing. There's also a range of power in that sequence. But basically, when you're in the poke-yoke level, you take the will away from the person and says, buddy, you are not going to do the wrong thing. Or, buddy, you are going to do the right thing. And we're going to use, now this is a credit card. There's only one way it'll work. You can put it in the bra. Go ahead.
Is a poke-yoke a device that kind of forces you to do it the right way? Like my power cord, you know, on my computer, my power cord and my USB, they have a different plug. So I don't mistakenly plug one into the other. That's an example of a poke-yoke.
Absolutely. Okay. And the more damage you can do, the more clever the device needs to be so that there's no choice, no choice. So it's that spectrum because the interface between the human and visuality is one that is so intimate, Keith, as to be causative. The language is the way the language is because humans are using it. You don't need visual devices if it's one AI to another AI. Or if it's one robot to another robot. But humans have a flood of emotional noise going on in their head, task noise, and just all of this mayhem going in their head. And they're around dangerous objects. We have to keep them safe. Or they want to do excellent work. We have to limit the choices. And in visuality, choices for the first 3, 4, 10 cycles in a company of the visual devices are made by the very people who work there, the very people who are in danger, the very people who are trying to do a task excellently well, whether that's a supervisor or a CEO, that's where the language is created. And then after a while, you get visual best practices. Those people either retire, they get promoted, whatever, they leave the company, somebody else comes in and benefits from it. There's a stage of visuality that where there's just a riot of new visual devices because we're creating the basis of the language. And after that, it can be built on. It can be built on.
So this visual devices, I believe, is a specific element of your work. But just to build context for everyone, visual devices are these things that are everywhere all around us. I was just talking about the snow, for example. I'm here in Utah, and in Utah, especially in like this, the spring, a few months ago, maybe, it'll snow in the morning and you go to a parking lot and you'll see a bunch of people who park when there's a little bit of snow on the ground. And then by the afternoon, the snow melts. And what you see is all these cars just parked in random places all over the parking lot. And so, you know, I know that you've got literally thousands of examples like this in your book, but let's just build a little context for a minute on visual devices that we all interact with all of the time that we might not even realize that that's examples of people doing this kind of work. And it just feels natural because it works. So
go ahead. So you're talking about the parking lot. What else comes to mind, Keith?
Yeah, speed bumps was a great example, right? Like putting a slow children playing sign probably didn't work. And so somebody's, well, what if we put a big bump in the road? Because if they don't pay attention to the sign, they'll hit this big bump, right? There's this evolution of these devices.
That's exactly.
I was at an airport recently and I'm looking out the window while I'm waiting for my plane and I see all these like lines, you know, on the ground. And I don't think that those had ever that I'd ever really paid that much attention to those until I saw a picture of one of them. I think it was in your book where you realize like, oh, that's all those little lines right there. Those are for different sized airplanes. So when they pull
those are language. Those are words. That's the vocabulary of the visual language. Those are the devices. You're exactly right. Exactly.
There's a phrase that I love, and there's a quote from, I'll remember his name in just a second, but I couldn't give a fig for the simplicity on the near side of complexity, but I'd give my left arm for the simplicity on the far side of complexity. And I know that in work, a lot of us, you know, you talk about standards and, you know, you're writing out SOPs And I was just having a conversation with someone where, like, there's this complexity that you go through when you're writing things out. But on the far side of that complexity, you make things simpler and more useful. And I think that's where this visuality works. When you get something just right, it takes the place of all of these words and all of these instructions.
Well, that does happen, but that's not the ideal way. And it is not necessary to wait until you make things complex to then decide to make them simple. Visuality runs on a track, can start at the same moment as your documentation. Visuality, for example, if you're documenting your standards, you can, as you focus on a standard, say, we're going to document the standard, but let's find at least 7 visual devices that will make that standard live in the work process itself. Let's create visual devices while we're creating the standard. So it doesn't have to be sequential. It can be in parallel. And I'm amazed. I do some work with TWI and the TWI consultants, but TWI is a completely brilliant intervention, very, very productive, very rich. But when it's all over, they come to me and say, hey, you know, is there a way to make this standard visual? Well, yeah. Yeah, there is. And in fact, why not do it? So there is a little wrongheadedness about how these improvement tools have to be chosen exclusively. But in fact, a lot of them fit very neatly together. Visual and Lean work very, very well together, for example. So yes, you are right. But the complexity comes, it's a different conversation. The corollary to that is, which is for pilots, engineers of the sky, so that they do the right thing, so they can find their plane, so they can dock their plane, so that they don't bump into another plane, so that when one plane is moving out and it's going onto a runway, it sees this double line followed by a dash line and knows when it sees the double line first that it cannot enter that runway until it gets permission. If it's reverse and the dotted line is the first thing I see as a pilot, I can just sail right through and I can keep flowing because this runway will not be a location of an accident. I'm free to go. So that same complexity of instruction that it's built into the runway can be built into the living landscape of a manufacturing company, most in particular, but also in pharmaceutical, also in different ways in offices, not exactly like that. But that same kind of clarity through borders. Not through lines. Lines don't function. Lines are an arithmetic element. They do not function. We call them borders. Through borders. And I'll just say this for the benefit of anybody who wants to look at my book, Work That Makes Sense, which is down here. Wonderful book about operator-led visuality. There aren't 2 types of borders, framing borders and aisle borders. There are 18 types of borders. 18. They were discovered by the operators that I've met and taught over the last many, 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 many years. They came up with borders that function with them that have never been seen on the planet before. So that's what I mean by developing the language. They're all visual devices, but the language, you have slanty borders, you have double function borders, you have dashed borders, you have person with borders, which allow you to both have the border, the boundary function, but also an aisle that's wide enough for you to walk between the piles of whip. Fabulous languaging, really on the level of exquisite language by operators, also by supervisors, what I was talking about before. So the language is there. It's a natural fit. Go ahead now.
So I want to ask you about some of the problems that I'll just say anybody listening to this, they might be facing it at home or at work. And the answer to that problem might be something to do with this visuality. And we'll kind of land towards this thing called Obeya. But I am curious, like, because there's all sorts of problems that happen. Like you shared, like, what do I need to know? What do I need to share? Where is my blank? All of these are examples of problems. deaths, fatalities, like things go wrong in the world, and perhaps visual devices could be answers to that. So can you give us like a list of maybe if you're having one of these kind of problems, visuality might be your solution?
I could, but whether or not people would see them as a logical extension of which would be a visual solution, I'd rather approach it in a somewhat different way. All of those things that you are naming, the accidents, whether on an airplane or picking the wrong bottle, it used to be hundreds and hundreds of years ago in the pharmacies of the Middle Ages, poison was put in a bottle that was textured. It had a texture to it. So that if the chemist was reaching for that bottle, they would know right away there was danger by feel, by touch. So, but what is it that's happening there? There's an information deficit. There's missing information that could cause problems because the information is not there. And that information on the bottle is, I'm poison. And I'm reaching for a bottle that's sitting next to another bottle, and I take the wrong bottle, and I pour it into somebody's medicine, the person's dead. And the next day, the little boy comes in, my mommy died. But he doesn't know that the mommy died because of the medicine that I gave him. But I pick up this bottle. So it's information deficits is the characteristic of the problems. It's when the missing information, and sometimes that information is subtle. It's a differentiation. You see this also in chemotherapy medication, where the two names, usually chemotherapy has three encletic parts. There's three parts of the name. Each of it means something. And if you don't see that differentiation, you pick the wrong chemotherapy. So now they increase the size of the first three letters. They make the middle letters a different color, and they do something different with the last three or four letters so that your eye sees the difference. Otherwise, it's just a name that says oxy something or other or chin something or other. Okay? So it's more like that. It's more understanding when you look at the problem, the accident, the catastrophe, what was the missing information? Chernobyl was this way. And the other place, Two Mile Island, there was information that was buried and not visible. That happened. It was a shutter that didn't happen. And nobody knew about it because they couldn't see it. They didn't have line of sight. And that doesn't happen anymore because that particular attribute is now recognized to be a potential killer. Do you see what I mean? So that's where visuality lives. It lives in the complexity of what's wrong, what's missing, what's been omitted, what has been bent, what has been misaligned, what is ready to blow, all of that. When you bring it to the level of, yikes, something bad's going to happen.
So if there's an information deficit, as people operating in our workplaces, if there's an information deficit, it's hard to see what isn't there, perhaps. What are some of the behaviors that we might
witness? That's exactly it. Go ahead, ask that question, and I've got the answer.
What are the behaviors that we will see in the workplace when there is that missing information? What is it that we see?
And there is a name for that. And this came floating down. I remember the day this came floating down. I was writing my first book on visuality. We call that motion. Motion is the footprint of that which is invisible. Right? That's the thing about information deficits. They're not there. They're deficits. They're not just invisible. They're not there. Okay, so it's missing information. The only way, well, I won't say the only way. We become scientists of motion. We become scientists that find the footprint of the missing information, that find the motion. And it's easy to do if you're, you know, we have terms of art. One of the terms of art is your value field. We use that a lot with the, we use it a lot with operators, but also supervisors and CEOs. And it's, where do you add
value field? Yeah, define value field.
Where do you add value? I add value with this microscope when I'm sitting at this desk. This desk is my value field.
So if I'm a drill press operator, it's while I'm at my drill press. If I'm a writer, it's while I'm punching in my the keys in
for the most part. For the most part, yeah. When you get into the arts, it gets a little bit wiggly because there's not an information deficit. There's a whole realm of the imagination and blah blah blah. But if you used your computer, you've got to be near your computer. I can't write without one. I can't do it longhand. I can take notes. So yeah, that's right. But it's the motion that is the footprint of the information deficits. And that is what we teach. When a plant wants to become self-sufficient in visuality, so it can grow its own language and it can keep going and go through iterations and refine that language and create best practices, best visual practices, that plant becomes an army of scientists who are looking for their motion. And people then become self-generative. They can, while they're doing their work, do self-detect, self-correct, notice where they almost made a mistake, and realize that somebody else might make it, and see that it was because of an information deficit. When it gets to be more advanced, people then anticipate where the deficits could happen, where the mistake could happen, and you get a very, very smart workforce. You get a workforce that thinks. People can't think if you don't give them the equipment, the names of things, and the orientation. If I ask people to create a language of visual devices right now, they would probably be able to keep going for 3 or 4 days, or maybe for another month if they use need to know, need to share, because that's a great help. If I don't teach them about motion, they won't be able to dig in because they won't be able to go further. They won't know how to correct themselves because they won't know what to look for. That is almost a mistake. You see, that's what drives, and that's what drives visuality, the understanding of motion. I don't want to get into a lecture, and I won't. And in fact, I won't because you're going to interrupt me. That's even better. I am going to say this. My complaint about 5S is not about 5S, it's that you can't develop 5S, you can't go further on 5S. It's a compliance activity. Therefore, it is given to an audit to say good, bad. But if you introduce motion and you take the elements of 5S, at least people will be able to go further and use the principles of 5S to dig into the landscape and take 5S further. That's the problem. 5S was never meant to be a developmental growth activity. It was compliance. That's the way Ono invented it. But you are depriving your operators of a tremendous contribution if you don't give them the tools for thinking and digging and discovering during the course of their own work how to make it better. This is not creativity. This is not brainstorming. This is not copying somebody's ideas. You can do all of those things, but when you want to go further on your own and you are not equipped to do it, you can't do it. It's called thinking.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com. We've got these different levels of work inside of an organization, right? We've got operator, we've got supervisors, we've got management, we've got senior CEO level work. And you're describing these visual devices and this eye-driven nature, which leads me down this path of at these different levels, there's probably different devices and different ways to solve these different problems for the different work to be done inside of an organization. I know that you're doing some work with Obeya currently. I'm curious if you could help orient us to the space of the problem where this Obeya thing, which we'll have to have you discuss with us. Yeah, take us in that direction.
All right. Let me put some definitions in place. One of the reasons why Keith is so interested in Obeya is because the name of his company is KPI Fire. And it has to do with KPIs, with key performance indicators, with metrics that illuminate, or they should illuminate. And the world of metrics was pretty much locked into place about 20 years ago when those guys, their names escape me, from Harvard Business School did the balanced scorecard. You can look up their names.
Yeah. Norton?
Something like that.
Yeah.
You can look it up if you want while I'm talking, or you don't have to. But the whole idea of numbers as being revelatory, revealing things, illuminating, entered our thinking. The Japanese had used them, of course, because they worked with Deming, SPC guru, somebody who was very familiar with statistics and how statistics revealed and trending and data gathering. So KPIs have a place, key performance indicators, the measures. How many did we make? How many were good? How many yielded feet? How many did we have to throw away? How much rework? How many defects? Things like that. Usually around quality, on-time delivery, safety, morale. I'm missing one of them.
SQDC. Sometimes I, sometimes P, sometimes M.
Yeah. So metrics. So what an obeya means is big room. The Japanese, and I took my first study mission over in 84, that's 1984, the Japanese were using metrics from the very beginning. Around 1990, they did a particular project, the Prius, and it was the first time the metrics were actually put into a room by intention. They were always on the walls. But people claim that the obeya began with the Prius in the 90s because they were on a hot deadline and they really needed all the information around them. So you can think of the four walls, and you can think that the walls are in sections, maybe around safety, quality. Here we are again, on-time delivery. Can you look those up so that we get
safety, quality, delivery, cost?
Cost, that's right. Cost, yeah. But there's others, there's morale.
Yeah, inventory.
Well,
people, like, I don't know.
Okay.
Morale.
So
people were.
Yeah. All right. The obeya room, it's interesting to me. I recently moved to Europe. I was living in the United States, and about 4 years ago, I moved to Europe, did some work in Warsaw with a consulting company, teaching them my work. And then now I've moved to English-speaking countries, to the western part of Europe, and working with some consulting companies here, and working with some obeya-interested companies also. But obeya is much more, there's much more interest in obeya here in Europe than in the United States. And I have a chance now. I'm involved with a couple of companies that want to do obeya and want to be trained in it. My orientation about obeya, about creating a room that centralizes, co-locates many, many of the metrics, maybe for project management, but maybe for the running of an entire plant, maybe for strategic decision-making, maybe for tactical decision-making. These are all different obeya rooms, depending on the group that's there and what their purpose is, has some, for me, exact corollaries to all of my work in visuality. It has to do with the effectiveness with which the numbers are encountered. What do you do with those numbers besides look at them and say, oh, this went up and this went down. And now this went up and now this one went down. Something beyond just monitoring the levels. So when I think about obeya, I think about it as a visual format. And I know that I need to enter that room with the intention of not just seeing, but discovering. Discovering that which is not seen yet. I go into the obeya and ask the two consultant level questions, the two sets that I ask when I'm on the operations floor or when I'm going into a boardroom, or I'm with supervisors, or I'm engineering, whatever it is. What am I seeing physically? What am I seeing? This is the first set. What does it mean? First set of questions. Second set of questions. What am I not seeing? What does that mean? What am I seeing? What does it mean? What am I not seeing? What does it mean? The problem that I see with Obeya in the absence of those questions is a very superficial encounter with numbers that talks about the convenience of having them in the room all together at once, so I don't have to run around the floor. My line of sight is these four walls. But it is not using those walls to calibrate, for example, Keith, what's next? What's missing? The room will lead to causality and will lead to problem solving if you are working with that understanding. But I have seen too many Obeya rooms simply stay on the same level. I've got a couple of things to say about it because I don't want people to feel trapped if my description applies to them. But in the early, so I need to really be careful to build a little bit of understanding about Obeya so we don't leave people adrift. The thing about Obeya is you have to first set it up. You have to get your walls in order. You have to decide which metrics go there. You have to decide who populates them, who updates them. And I myself, if we're starting from scratch, I want the people in the room to be responsible for the updates so that they learn where the data comes from. I am opposed. Just hold on for a second, okay? I've got about three or four paragraphs here. I'm opposed because we're giving a little primer on Obeya, and we want to serve people correctly with a little robustness, so they don't jump to say, "Oh, I'm doing it wrong. I'm doing it right." She doesn't know. He doesn't know. Blah blah blah. We want to have a good conversation here. So it's a really good way to start. Start modestly and say, "We're going to put numbers up." You might even have two rooms. Two rooms, if you've got an emergency, you've got your numbers up there and you got to get them up there. You don't care how they get up there. They just have to get up there because you've got a crisis and because it's really handy to have this information all at once. Good. But in another room, you say, now let's build a competency of Obeya and let's find out where those numbers come from. Because unless you know where the numbers come from and you go and get them yourself, you won't know if that data is, number one, not worth getting, number two, the wrong data, number three, too hard to get, there must be an easier way. So that whole piece is the beginning developmental piece, and it should be done in stage one. Stage one, you're dealing with the data, you're getting it on the walls, you begin to interact with it. You don't have to be more ambitious than that. Stage two is where you look at the effectiveness of the group and whether or not they are in a process of discovery, using the numbers to discover or just to monitor and react. And you want to shift that into more of an investigation. The third stage, I'll just say, has to do with learning how to drive through the numbers. And then morphing into what's called a war room, where you're really driving outcomes. But that can't happen at the beginning. You need one, two, you need at least those three stages.
And that's where we'll pause for today's episode. I hope you are enjoying this deep dive with Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth as much as I am. There's so much to unpack about the visual workplace. In the next episode, we'll continue the conversation and shift into the Obeya room. What it is, how it works, and why it might be the most powerful leadership tool that you may not be using yet. So make sure to join us for part two. It's packed with insights on metrics that drive action, building systems that eliminate waste, and Gwen's 10-doorway framework that will change how you think about visuality.